I'm Grant Heading, President of the SA Press Club, and welcome to today's luncheon. I must say, it feels very odd to stand up here and welcome our guest speaker. I mean, he's been coming to these lunches longer than I have, and probably longer than most of you have as well. And let's hope he will continue to do so in the future. Rarely has Rex Drury had an excuse to leave a press club luncheon early. Today he has absolutely none. Retired for 1 week, he's a gentleman of leisure, and I think he's spending all his time going to farewell parties. He's got another one tonight. Rex, you're leaving Nellie Melba for dead. And I'll formally introduce Rex a little later. May I offer a special welcome to Opposition Leader Martin Hamilton-Smith and his deputy, Vicky Chapman. And from our group of generous sponsors, we have Brian Hillier, Regional Manager of Telstra Business, Rob DeMonte, Managing Partner of Deloitte, and Jeff Timms from Timms Manufacturing. Our wines and beers today on the tables supplied by two other very important sponsors, Pernod Ricard and SA Brewing. There are raffle tickets on your table, you'll see there, $3, $4, $5, so dig deep there. A cordless phone from Telstra, a $300 gift voucher from Timms Manufacturing Jewellers, and there's a beer carton down here from SA Brewing. Welcome and enjoy your lunch, and I'll be back shortly. If I can just have your attention again, please. Excuse me. When Rex Drury announced his retirement, he reflected on how a nervous young boy from Henley Beach, fresh out of school and untrained in the hard ways of the adult world, got away with so much for so long without being found out. Perhaps we should ask how he managed to get away with so many long lunches, with so much red wine for so long. Of course, Rex would argue it was all work anyway, cultivating contacts and ruminating with his readers. And let's face it, no one does it better than Rex. But after 48 years, Rex doesn't have to justify himself to anyone anymore. The Pulitzer Prize-winning American columnist Jimmy Breslin once wrote, "Rage is the only quality which has kept me or anybody I have ever studied writing columns for newspapers." Well, perhaps Rex has lost the rage. Adelaide, and more particularly the Tiser, has lost one of his finest journalists and best-known raconteurs, a writer who helped shape public opinion and prodded our collective conscience. Rex's extraordinary ride, as he calls it, through journalism, began as a copy boy with the News in 1960. He's worked with the BBC in London, spent a year in South Africa, and was appointed political writer for the News in 1970. He had a stint in the Canberra Bureau, then was made editor of the Sunday Mail before returning to the Tiser as political editor. He's one of the best-known faces around town. He's written countless editorials and columns, met everyone from politicians to prostitutes, rock stars to royalty. Yet, through all those years, no one could ever accuse Rex of being intoxicated with his own self-importance. Maybe a bit of red, though, if the truth's known. And Rex, if we can prize you away from that glass of red now, we'd love to hear from you.
This lectern is on a float, so you can't put glasses up here. I've asked about it. Otherwise, I'd have a glass up here. Thank you, Grant, for those comments. It's an absolute privilege to be invited here today. I've been on the board of the Press Club for, I think, almost since it started, about 12 or 15 years ago. And I know about the finances, so I suspect I've been invited here today because there's no travelling expenses, no hotels, no fees, and they probably won't give me a bottle of booze at the end either. Well, that's a risk that I'm prepared to take because the Press Club has been, it's become an institution in South Australia and I think a worthwhile one. To you all here today, thank you for coming. I regard that as a compliment to myself. I thought that we'd have the Press Club board and a few sundry hangers-on listening to what they think is going to be me reminiscing. It's not so. In fact, I want to start at a date in history before I was in journalism. Now, that goes back a bit. In fact, the date is September 20, 1826, 182 years ago. So we've got a long lunch, haven't we? We're going to catch up on all that time. On that day, two privates in the 57th Regiment based in Sydney, Joseph Suds and Patrick Thompson, decided that they were sick of army life, they were going to create a bit of trouble, get to court, be prosecuted and fined, and drummed out the army, either to be taken back to England or let free in New South Wales. So they went to a... Don't you love him? So they went to a shop in York Street in... Thanks, Robert. It's a modern miracle, Robert. They went to a shop in York Street in Sydney and they pinched a bit of cotton, put it over their shoulder and walked out, and the man said, "Stop, police," and that's exactly what they wanted. They were arrested, and in due course they went to court. But Joseph Suds and Patrick Thompson weren't all that smart because the judge gave them 7 years in a penal colony, either Norfolk Island or Tasmania, which is pretty harsh. They got out the army, but they were going to end up 7 years in Norfolk Island. But then the New South Wales governor, Lieutenant Governor General Ralph Darling, stepped in and he set aside the penalty and set aside the convictions. Good news for Joseph Suds and Patrick? No, it wasn't. Instead, he ordered Suds and Thompson to serve 7 years working in chain gangs building Sydney roads. Darling believed that transportation from England to Australia had lost its deterrent effect, and he believed that discipline in the armed forces in Sydney was waning, and he wanted to make these poor sods, not suds, but sods, a bit of an example. So on November 22, 1826, Suds and Thompson were in chains, 7 kilogram chains, including collars with spikes on the inside so they couldn't lay down, were dragged before their garrison, stripped and flogged, and then set to work on the roads. On November 25, Joseph Suds died, just a few days later. And that raised the interest of the local media. And there were two newspapers in those days, The Australian, which is probably a precursor to The Australian of today. I think Rupert bought the masthead from someone, and a newspaper called The Monitor, and they both railed against Governor Darling. They said that his actions were illegal, that his decision had breached British law. He'd breached the definite and defined line between executive government on the one hand and the courts or the judiciary on the other. He'd used his position to overrule the courts. He defied the convention of separation of powers. Darling was furious at this attack, so he went to the Chief Justice, Sir Francis Forbes, and said, could you give me a ruling on this? Because all I've done is reorganise someone's penalty. It's surely not that bad. So Sir Francis Forbes, the Chief Justice, thought about this, and he said that Darling had, in effect, set aside a sentence and imposed a new sentence by executive fiat. And he said, this is the assumption of the judicial role. He had, said Forbes, undermined the independence of the judiciary. Darling was furious at this, so to overcome the problem, he introduced a fourpenny tax. There'll be no one here that remembers pennies, I don't suppose, but it was a denomination of coin. He brought in a fourpenny tax on every edition of a paper on a certain day which he believed offended him. And it was his decision and his discretion alone to impose this tax. In other words, if he did impose the tax, he'd send the newspaper broke. And he introduced legislation which went through the Legislative Council, the only House of Parliament at those days, and it was of course passed, and all it required was a certificate from the Chief Justice saying that the law was consistent with British law. But our friend Forbes again stepped in, Sir Francis Forbes, and he refused to sign the certificate. He said that by the proposed bill, a preliminary licence is required, which is to destroy the freedom of the press and place it at the discretion of the government. He said that printing and publishing was a common right of all people and should be freely exercised. The free press, he said, is a constitutional right. It is one of the privileges of being a British subject. And if you take away the freedom of the public opinion, you take away the right of individual freedom. Those freedoms, the separation of powers, that is the Parliament and the judiciary, and the freedom of speech, the freedom of opinion, the freedom of publication, the freedom of the media, exist today in large terms because of the sacrifice, if you like, of Joseph Sudds. No one's ever heard of him. He's my favourite Australian history figure. And he did a great deal. Patrick Thompson, it's a thesis for someone to find out what happened to him. He just disappeared into history. But Sudds and Thompson were the two that forced the government to recognise separation of powers and the absolute freedom of the press. That was 182 years ago. And today the fight over the freedom of the press continues. And I use the word press as an all-embracing term for the media, the expanding media. And it really embraces the freedom of the press, personal freedom of speech, freedom of opinion, freedom of association, freedom of movement. And all those freedoms in the 48 or 49 years since I started in journalism have been severely eroded, I think, to a point of deep concern. We look now just briefly at Beijing and see what happens in a country which has no culture of press freedom. They are doing what they like to ban the world's media from gaining access to information which they believe will be embarrassing to them. And in Australia, we're going slowly, brick by brick, down that same path. We've allowed laws which give authorities power to lock up suspected terrorists without trial or without charge. National security has become an excuse to prevent the general broadcast of news. It's become an excuse to suppress the media. The British philosopher Sir Karl Popper once wrote, "We must plan for freedom, and not only for security, if for no other reason than that only freedom can make security secure." Take the courts. Awards in libel and slander cases are becoming prohibitive. They are deterring the media from attempts to expose corruption, fraud, and humbug. And I'm not saying I was right and they were wrong, but last week I got pinged for $60,000 for writing what I thought was a witty line about a minister. It is happening increasingly, and the threats through stop writs and so on is increasing. It's the very weapon that Governor Darling tried to impose in a different way 182 years ago. In government, ministers now all have press secretaries. So does Leader of the Opposition and other senior opposition figures. Government departments have media advisers and press secretaries, private companies, trade unions, churches, industry organisations. They're not there to provide information. They're there to deny information. The British playwright Tom Stoppard said, and I think he caught the feeling of the politicians when he said, "I'm with you on the free press. It's just those bloody newspapers I can't stand." In Parliament, the heartbeat of democracy, the media now is only allowed to photograph or film the person speaking. In Britain, newspapers were heavily fined when they ran photographs of backbenchers asleep. Now, don't constituents have a right to know that their Member of Parliament is flaked out on the backbench? But no, Parliament says we must restrict it only to the Speaker. Someone a few years ago walked into the House of Assembly, a stranger, and got almost to the feet of the Prime Minister before he was restrained. A couple of newspapers ran the picture of what is an extraordinary event, and in South Africa it happened and the Prime Minister was stabbed 40 years ago. The papers that ran the photograph were banned from Parliament House for 7 days. Don't people have a right to know what's happening in their own Parliament? Don't politicians understand that it's not their Parliament, it's our Parliament? But increasingly, the freedoms are being diminished. Telstra, when it was 51% owned by the federal government, made an attempt to buy the Sydney Morning Herald. The potential purchase, was exposed by News Limited newspapers. And as soon as it was in the papers, Telstra said, "Oh, no, that's a misunderstanding. No, don't be silly." And the government of the day said, no, we would never have allowed it. Not much they wouldn't have. If the Telstra, and therefore the federal government, could have bought the Sydney Morning Herald and the Melbourne Age, they would have snapped it up. But how close it was only that the negotiation was picked up by another newspaper and it was published, and then everyone denied it was going to happen. Journalists are now, under security laws, being threatened more and more with imprisonment if they don't reveal their sources. There was a famous case in Melbourne last year, two journalists who exposed the fact that the government was attempting to reduce Veterans Affairs privileges and payments. War veterans. And they ran the story. The story was right. The government backed away, yet the government took the journalists to court to find out who was the source of the story. If the story was right, why bother? Surely it's the job of a newspaper to expose those things and let people make up their own mind. And as soon as the people heard about it, they said, "This is an outrage. The veterans should have those privileges." It goes on and on. The courts are consistently suppressing the names of accused people. In some cases, where the identity of children, perhaps, or there's a danger that someone is going to be attacked, there are cases where suppression of that information is justified. But it seems that if a defence lawyer gets up now and says, "I would like the name of my client suppressed," it almost inevitably happens. What's that lead to? It leads to rumour, it leads to innuendo, it leads to mistaken identity, and as much damage is done as simply releasing the name. Technically, a politician on a murder charge before an election could have his or her name suppressed, could be in prison, and because the name is suppressed, and the person is still technically innocent, could run and win an election because their name is suppressed. Now, there may be technical reasons why that can't happen, but it's pretty darn close to being right. And as public accountability evaporates, opportunities are being created for abuse and corruption. The British newspaper proprietor Lord Northcliffe said, "The power of the press is very great, but not so great as the power of suppress." It's the responsibility of every person here and every person you talk to and see today to be vigilant about the continued erosion of press powers, media powers in Australia. You should rail against this slow destruction. Only when we don't have these freedoms will we really know how important they are. Just ask the Chinese. I wonder, how much time have I got, Grant?
You're right.
I want to lighten it up a bit. In the early 1970s, I was writing politics for the news, and the government of the day introduced legislation to abolish capital punishment. There hadn't been a hanging since 1964. The government felt strongly about it, but there was strong public reaction to it. People said, no, hanging's a deterrent, it's a good thing. My editor, Ron Boland, said, go to Len King, the Attorney General, and ask him to write 400 words justifying his decision to abolish it, and go to Randa Garris, who was the leader of the opposition in the Legislative Council, a high Tory, man who used to wear morning coats into the Legislative Council, and ask him to write 400 words on why he wants capital punishment maintained. So I went to the attorney and he said, I'm happy to do that. And I went to De Garris. I was terrified of him in those days. I said, Mr. De Garris, would you write 400 words justifying the retention of capital punishment? And he said, you don't believe in capital punishment, do you? And I said, no, I don't. I think the government's doing the right thing. And he said, all right. He said, you write it. And I said, but I don't believe it. And he said, no, you do it. So I went back to him. I went to Hansard and read his speeches and got his justification. And I wrote 400 words on why capital punishment should be retained, according to Randa Garris. And I gave it to him and he said, you happy with it, young fella? And I said, yeah. Well, not happy with it, but I think you'll be happy with it. I think it puts your point of view. He said, okay. And I said, aren't you going to read it? And he said, no. And so I took it back to the office and it went in the paper. And about 3 days later, he said, he rang me and he said, g'day, young fellow. I couldn't have said it better myself. I tell that story because in recent years and over the years since I started reporting politics, there's been a breakdown of trust between journalists and politicians, which I think is detrimental both to the media and therefore the public and also to democracy. A man never reveals his sources, of course, but I had a very good relationship with Jack Wright, who was Deputy Premier. Jack believed that you could trade information. Now, I didn't have much information to trade, but Jack would sometimes ring me and say, g'day, comrade, I haven't heard from you for a while, 2 or 3 days, what's going on? And, of course, as Deputy Premier, he knew a hell of a lot about what was going on in government. And so Jack was, I liked to do trade with Jack, it was good. He was a great help to me. And one night he rang me at home and he said, g'day, comrade. And I said, g'day, Jack. And he said, my lad is thinking about becoming a journalist. What would it require? And I said, well, what he would have to do is start work at 6 o'clock. He'd have to wash all the coffee cups that are lying around the office. And then he would have to make coffee for the journalists as they came into work. Then he'd have to ride a bike around town delivering messages. He'd have to go and get people's lunches. He'd have to ride a bike out to 5DN and deliver the news bulletins, which in those days were read by Mel Cameron or someone. And I said, it's a hard start, but if you get through that, then you become a cadet journalist and you go on from there. And the next night he rang me, he said, g'day, comrade. And I said, g'day, Jack. And he said, my son's decided not to become a journalist. He's now a Minister of Police, oddly enough. So he probably made the right choice. Certainly financially he made the right choice. I was on an aircraft coming back from a Premier's conference once, and Greg Kelton over there and I have done many Premier's conferences, or COAG as they're called today, and the state government had been hammered financially, the under-treasurer was sitting across the aisle from me. I can't believe he would have travelled at the back of the plane, so in those days Rupert must have been flying us in the front of the plane. I can't believe that either, but anyway. He and his deputy were going through a big sheet of things and they were putting blue pencil lines through them. And I said, what are you blokes up to? And he said, well, we're crossing out the projects that we can't afford now that we've had a cut in money. And I said, geez, that is pretty tough. He said, oh, well, it's the only way we can do it. We're that far behind financially. We just can't afford to do these things. And a bit later on, he stood up with the sheet and he put it on the lap. And he said, will you hold that a minute? I just want to speak to the Premier. And he went down to the front of the plane, and there they all were for me. All I had to do was look at them. I'm not going to tell you what I did, but it was a bloody good story. But he knew what I was going to do. He knew why he'd done it. It worked for his interests. Probably worked for the government's interests. Sure as hell it worked in mine. But that sort of trust is gone. You give me a bell, Grant. Years ago, I was called back from holidays to go overseas with the Prime Minister. It was Malcolm Fraser in those days. And so I was in Melbourne. I flew back to Canberra and packed a bag and went to... On the way to the airport, I went to Parliament House. And I ran into someone that probably a lot of you would know of if you don't know. And I said, what are you doing here on a Sunday? And he said, well, what are you doing? And I said, oh, I'm going overseas with the Prime Minister. And he said, oh, I've just seen him. He said, I'm on the PM's Taxation Review Committee, and we've just put in our report on what we think some changes to the taxation system. And I said, how'd you go? And he said, oh, he loved them. Yeah, he's going to accept them. That'll be fine. And he said, do you want to know what they were? I said, no, I don't want to know. And he said, well, the key to it was that everyone, whether you earn $200,000 or $20,000, everyone will get a $10 tax cut. So that was pretty undemocratic, but nonetheless. I said, well, thanks for that, but I can't do much with it. He said, hey, when you're overseas, you could write the story over there and some poor bastard on the plane will get into trouble because we're on the Prime Minister's private plane. He said, someone on the plane will get into trouble. They won't know it's me. So we'd been away 3 or 4 days and we were in Hawaii. Lots of Prime Ministers stay in Hawaii a long time. And we had not much to do. So on the last day, I wrote the story saying everyone was going to get a $10 tax cut. And I was working for all the afternoon papers, the Murdoch afternoon papers in Brisbane and Adelaide and Sydney and so on. And they lapped the story up. And as we were flying to San Francisco, David Barnett, the Prime Minister's press secretary, came down the back of the plane and said, the Prime Minister wants to see you. Malcolm's a big man. He's got huge hands and a terrible temper. And I sat down and he just roared shit out of me. He said, if you're going to write rubbish like this, you're off the plane. I'm not going to have you on this plane if you're going to write rubbish like this. So I went back and David came back with me and he said to the press corps, about 12 of us flying together, he said, the Prime Minister has absolutely denied the story that Jury has written and you can run it as a denial. It's wrong. And I was sitting with Laurie Oakes and Laurie said, is the story right or not? And I said, yeah, it's right. And Laurie said, yeah, the story's right, fellas. And about 6 or 8 weeks later, everyone in Australia got a $10 tax cut. And I don't know whether Malcolm Fraser did it or Laurie Oakes did it or I did it, but but again, it came down to a point of trust. And I came to Adelaide when I was living in Canberra. I came to Adelaide with Malcolm once, and you won't be able to stop me, right? And we stayed at the pub opposite Parliament House. It used to be called the Ansett Gateway in those days. Rupert owned it, as a matter of fact. But it's called something else now, but it's a nice hotel. And in those days, it had a first floor, white tablecloth, silver service dining room. So 3 or 4 journalists that I was travelling with said, let's book a table, because that's what you always did. So we went up and one of them said, I don't want to drink anything grown in Australia. And so we only drank French. And a bit later, Malcolm came in and he sat on the other side of the dining room. And I called the waiter over. He just had one fellow with him, a businessman or something. I called the waiter over and I said, look, we'd like to buy the Prime Minister a bottle of wine. And the waiter that was serving that table came over and said, sir, did you want to order something? And I said, yes, could you give the Prime Minister a bottle of Basket Press with the compliments of the media? And he went away and he came back and he said, the Prime Minister says thank you, sir, but he would prefer the Grange. So it was a year or two ago, but I'd be $1,000 a bottle now, I suppose, and that went on my bill. Anyway, we went on drinking, and late in the night, a shadow fell across the table, and there was Malcolm, and he had the biggest brandy balloon you've ever seen. And I called the waiter over, and I said, "I don't care what's in that, keep it topped up." And Malcolm sat down with us, and he had his trousers on, but he was well pissed. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, he started coming forward with all sorts of cabinet secrets. I was bleary-eyed, but I couldn't believe what I was hearing. But the others at the table, the other journalists, were morning newspaper people, and their editions had long gone. So when at 3 o'clock Malcolm got up and left, I went up to my room and I wrote down everything I could remember. And then in the morning I phoned through these stories, which again went round to all the afternoon newspapers. And then I got on a plane and I flew home. And when I got home, my wife said, "God, Prime Minister's office has been screaming for you." So I rang up and they said, "The Prime Minister wants to see you straight away." So I went into Parliament House and I went into his office and they said, "The Prime Minister will see you straight away." And I walked in and there were two people sitting on my side of the desk, and there was Malcolm sitting there, and he had all these papers laid out in front of him with all these stories about tax cuts and all sorts of things, and which he'd blithered out during the night. Now, I didn't quote him. I just said, "It's likely that there's going to be a cabinet reshuffle," or "This is likely." That's it. It was fabulous. I didn't quote him. And he looked at me and he said, "I demand to know the source of these stories." I looked at him and I said, "Prime Minister, I cannot reveal my sources." And I saw this look of absolute, "Oh, thank Christ for that," come across his face. And then he said, "I'm going to institute an immediate inquiry into this, and these two fellows are going to do it." And they said, "Where did you get the story from?" I said, "I can't tell you." And that was the end of the inquiry, as best I got it. But again, it highlights the perhaps old-fashioned relationship that did exist between governments or politicians and the media, which I think has been largely destroyed because of the wedge that's been put in by the need to filter, the need to deny information, the need to put everything through the press secretariat, rather than journalists being able to deal on a one-to-one basis with politicians. For years I rang Don Dunstan every morning when he was Premier. For years I had a close relationship with the opposition leader, and it was a one-to-one. There was a trust basis. Okay, I would have made mistakes. Okay, I probably gave them all the stick at some stage or other, but perhaps deep down they respected that. I could go on, but I'm not going to. All I want to say is that it's been a hell of a ride. It's been an absolute privilege to be invited here today. It's been an absolute privilege to work for 5 decades in this industry. Thank you all for coming. Is there Grange in this, or is it? Thank you all very much.
I must admit I was mistaken. I don't think, Rex, you've lost any of your rage. Well said. Look, I'm sure there are some questions there. Please feel free to... this is a great opportunity to ask Rex's opinion on anything. That's on Red Mind. So, please.
I don't quite understand why governments don't trust the people. And in denying access to information and distilling all the information, governments are denying people the information which they should be able to base their judgments on when they vote. Now, if a government is doing a good job, what possible fear can they have that the people aren't going to like what they're doing? If the government has something to hide, okay, build your barriers. But in the end, a good government, chased by a good opposition, and I don't think there is such a thing as a city or a system which has a good government and a bad opposition. Just like if you only had Woolworths, prices would go up, but competition's a good thing. And while the opposition chases a government, while the media chases a government and tries to expose corruption and fraud and humbug and keeps their feet on the ground, I think we've got a good balance. Because the people have got a right to know. And less are governments recognising that right. As I said, I support the concept of freedom of the press, but I don't like newspapers. And newspapers are much broader now. They embrace everything from television and radio and now online and everything else, but we call it freedom of the press. I think without that, society is pretty much a dead goose. So I think that we all should rail against continued erosion of this freedom.
Another question down there?
Kevin Norton from the Senate Creek District Climate
Service. You've been promoted.
A couple of quick questions, and these are away from politics. These are very South Australian things, if you like. Firstly, where are the Beaumont children? And secondly, who built Marie Man?
I'll speak to you afterwards about the Beaumont children. Marie Man was one of the great things, wasn't it? And I think it was one of the great tragedies that, and I don't want to blame government, but the society let slide away. I mean, this was a remarkable thing. I don't know who built it. It sounds like it was a bunch of American airmen who had the capacity to draw it on a computer and then transpose it onto the ground with bulldozers. And it was a wonderful thing. This is truly Australian humour. This is something that was funny. It was something that created a laugh. We all laughed about it. We were all mystified about it. And we should have kept it. I don't know how we could have kept it. That's not for me, but fill it all with white rocks or chalk or something. I don't know. But that's not beyond the wit of man. But we couldn't be bothered spending the money to preserve something that had international appeal, and people wanted to fly over it. But I guess, five winters, five summers, it's probably gone now. And I don't care who built it, but it's typical of South Australia that we let it die.
Are
you standing up or sitting down?
I'm sitting down, Rick. I'm sitting down. The Old Fashioned Trust, and I was lucky enough to be around in those days too. But I'm just wondering, was the writing on the wall when a former press secretary became
I
general?
I can't hear you properly. Can you hear me?
Sorry, I'll speak closer. Was the writing on the wall when a former press secretary went on to become premier, and now also we see so many members of our profession going on to be press secretaries?
I'm not quite sure that I got that question.
Was the writing on the wall when a former press secretary went on to become premier?
Yeah, there's been a lot of journalists that have worked their way up into politics. And I think there'll probably be more. Journalists who work in politics or work near politics are savvy to both sides of it. And they recognise the power of the press, but once you get into politics, you can also recognise how to quell or contain or control that power. And I'm not saying journalists should be banned from politics, but it is a very strong connection that a journalist can do well in politics because they know the system and they know the pitfalls. A businessman or a business person who goes into politics has ideals, but they don't recognise just how harsh and tough democracy can be. And politicians who have come through the school of journalism understand that, and they gear themselves to avoid those pitfalls. The alternative, of course, is to have someone by your side who can ring the bell and say, today you can do this, but don't do that. Speak to this guy, but don't tell him this, so on and so on. But if you've already been in the paddock, you have a terrific advantage. And the politicians in recent times, like Tony Blair, who have been able to work the media, have been the most successful politicians. And working the media is one thing. Denying the media is another. You can work the media to your advantage by taking them into your trust, and we get back to that initial theme.
Freedom of information as a government policy. Secondly, do you see the advent of the citizen journalist as in internet blogs and that sort of thing damaging the credibility of the traditional media?
Freedom of information is one of the most ill-named concepts we've got. It's not freedom of information at all. It's denial of information. You can ask for information. It takes sometimes weeks to get from a government, and when you get it, it's got black lines all the way through it which deny information. So it's called a freedom of information because that is a good spin phrase. What it has done is allow politicians to say, if you want that information, you go and apply for it, and that puts a handbrake on the debate. Lets the debate go out for perhaps 3 months before part of the information is given to the media. I think freedom of information is an evil adjunct to the erosion of democracy. The move into new technology, if that's what you're referring to, online and so on, we were talking about it earlier at our table, and one of the things that's happening with that is that it is the area of the young. And we've got some terrific kids at the Advertiser, 20, 23, 24, 25 years of age and so on. And they are seriously talented people. They're well educated, they're smart, they can tear you down in debate, but they haven't got experience. And they are being plunged into this whole new area of online, of technological journalism, and they're leading it. And people like Greg Kelton, who has the experience and the contacts and the knowledge, have become an adjunct to it rather than they're not at the sharp end of it, because the technocrats are really at the sharp end of it. And I think that has diminished the standard of journalism, not the standard of the individual, but overall, I think journalism has suffered because of the need for speed and the need to bow to technology. In the London Telegraph, for instance, a reporter will go out to a press conference, come back, sit at his desk, his or her desk. There is a camera. They will then say, at the press conference, the Prime Minister announced that taxes were going to increase by $10 a head. Then they'll do an audio piece, and then, and only then, will they sit down to write their newspaper piece. They're multi-skilled, and it's a fantastic umbrella of talent that these people have got, but they are dealing with immediacy rather than reflection. And I think what we've lost with what we are losing with this online journalism is we're losing reflection and we are gaining immediacy. But there is a headlong charge to get the news out first. And that used to be, which newspaper get it on the streets first? Now is it, can we get out at 10 to 11 to beat 5AA getting it out at 11 o'clock? And we're finding that at 6 o'clock in the morning, people are now going straight to online. When we started online, they were on at 9 o'clock when they got to work. Now they're going out at 6 o'clock, so they want to know what happened overnight. And the need for immediate news, whether it's the petrol prices or cricket scores, doesn't matter what it is becoming almost an obsession within the public, which the media's got to pander to. But in pandering to speed, I think we are losing some of the standards of journalism, if that answers your question.
Rex, that obviously raises the question. I mean, where do you see the future for newspapers?
I think we'll still be getting a newspaper over our fence in 15 years, but I don't think the newspaper will be the news-breaking element of the news cycle. I think newspapers are going to become more a vehicle for opinion, for reflection. You will be able to listen to 5AA at 7 o'clock in the morning. I don't have to get up at that time anymore, but some do. You'll be able to go online, and you'll be able to go into your telephone, and you'll be able to get news as it's happening. But all you'll get is the news. That is, the Prime Minister today survived a no-confidence motion. The vote was 71-69. That's all you'll get. What you won't get is the detail of the vote, that is the scramble before and after, but also what you won't get is the background to why 71 people voted for the Prime Minister. Can he now hang on? Will he be usurped in 3 months? Has he done a deal? And it's that background information, what I would call in this room the Kelton information, that newspapers are going to push their way forward and become or continue to be a necessary part of the news cycle. Sure, you'll be able to get your information, whether Fred Smith made 100 or whoever won the 100 metres at the Olympic Games. You'll get that instantly. You'll be able to get it on your phone through Telstra. But you won't know the tactics of how someone won the 10,000 metres. You'll have to read the papers to find out. And the newspapers will have a role in that cycle.
Kim, OK.
Well, the best moment's hazy, the worst moment's easy. I was in Calgary by myself. I was in a hotel. I looked at my agenda, and it said that I had to go to an oil and gas function that night. I turned up, and I must say that this man was ushering me along as if I was important, and he opened the door, and I went into a room, and a man stepped forward and said, "John! Hank Ketchup, I'm the Chief Minister of Calgary," or whatever the state is. "And this is my wife, Ruby, and this is my Resources Minister, Jack Dunham." And I went down this line, and it became clear that he thought I was John Olsen. And John Olsen wasn't even in Canada. But how it happened, it's a bit blurry. And I thought, well, I could bluff my way through a cocktail party. And he said, "Come on down, John." And we went down and we went through these double doors. I can remember it now. It's like watching a car crash. It was all in slow motion. And we went in and there was a banquet for 1,000 people. And they were all obviously oil and gas people. You could tell by the way they were dressed, the Japanese hand-stitched suits and so on. And we sat at a top table, elevated. And Hank, or whatever his name was a shortcut man, and I was the opposition leader from South Australia. Well, the opposition leader from Australia is good enough, really, isn't it? And so we talked nonsense at the table. I probably ate my doily instead of the dinner. I was so nervous. And finally he got up to speak. Thank God for that. And I was sitting there, I wasn't listening to him. I was just able to relax for the first time. And I heard him say, "And with me tonight I have a very special guest, John Olsen from Australia. He's the leader of the opposition in Australia. And I'd like to ask John to address you on the options of oil and gas in Australia. Ladies and gentlemen, the next Prime Minister of Australia, Mr. John Olsen." Well, I didn't know what to do. I thought of fainting or running away. Anyway, I stood up and I spoke for some length of time. I've got no idea. About oil and gas, about the Timor Gap, and all sorts of things I knew nothing about. If I didn't know something, I made it up. 100 million barrels here, and and I finally sat down. I got a standing ovation from 1,000 people. I probably attracted millions of dollars worth of investment into South Australia. I sat down, I went up to my room, I didn't dare turn on the television set, and about 3 years later, John Olson asked me to speak at a gathering he'd got together of business people, and I told that story, and he wasn't pleased, but there you go. So that was the worst moment by far. It was probably the worst minute of my life, that episode.
I've been holding the microphone for about 5 minutes, and you've got a little bit of an optic problem. Barry Barrister, Rex, we've been associated for years over the milk industry, public relations, agriculture, rotary, conservation and things like that. And your life is a part of being tested by people like myself who want advertising and publicity through you without payment. How do you sort all the wheat from the chaff on these things? When good blokes like me have got something great to tell you and all the other people have got nothing to say.
Barry, I'll go as far with that question as to say this. One of the elements which persuaded me to step down from journalism has been the constant pestering from people who want something for nothing. And I don't say that in any nasty way at all. But I get in the morning, there's 150 emails. Some of them from Viagra, and I don't know how they know, but anyway. Some of them want to sell you steak knives, and some of them... I have one woman who three times a week tells me she's going to commit suicide, and 3 days a week I have to send back to her saying, Joanna, the sun came up today, it's going to be a beautiful day, and she'll send back saying, thank you, you're right. And then 2 days later she comes again. And I don't know who's going to look after her. I have people who say that the little strips they put on the road to fill the cracks in the roads, the little shiny strips, are dangerous when they're wet and they cause accidents, and why aren't I doing something about it? I have people asking me to speak at functions, people asking me to publicise events, and it is, quite honestly, wearing. I could spend every lunchtime and every dinner at a public function somewhere, and I know it's immensely kind of people and it's immensely flattering that they should care and that they should get in touch with me, but you can't meet their demands. You can't, I mean, Grant would know, everyone in journalism here would know that people pester you for favours, and you can't meet them, and sometimes when you don't meet them they abuse you, they criticise you, we've got a little wall in where I used to sit. Some of the greatest abusive letters you've ever seen there, and a few of the fellows over here have seen it. And you would think that I was the devil's right-hand man sometimes. And quite frankly, I got sick of that. It really dragged me down. And I look at the politicians here today who must feel the same way, because you're a public figure, whether you like it or not, and people feel they've got a right to grab you and they own you. It must be worse as a politician. I don't really know how politicians do it. But it was one of the factors that convinced me that it was time to go and smell the roses and fade away. But let me remind you of this. My dear old mate Des Cahoon retired early. Everyone here would know of Des Cahoon. Some of you would know him. And Des was in the street one day and someone came up to him and said, didn't you used to be Des Cahoon? Well, from now on, I used to be Rex Jury.
I would now like to call on a former competitor and colleague, long-time colleague of Rex's, Greg Colton, to propose a vote of thanks. Greg Hilton.
set up?
Yes. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. It's an honour and a privilege to be here to propose a vote of thanks to my esteemed colleague. Rex and I go back a long way. It's probably a measure of how far back we go that when he and I first crossed paths, question time in Parliament went for 2 hours, there were no press secretaries. And he was the political reporter for the news, and I was I'd just been promoted to the Advertiser's parliamentary team reporting Parliament. I used to envy him because as soon as the first question was asked in question time, he nicked off because he'd write the first stories of the last edition of the news and we'd never see him again. And we'd have to sit there for the next 2 hours listening to the crap that went on from the politicians. I was asked to mention a few anecdotes about Rex. Most of them I couldn't repeat. And I boiled it down to 2 stories, one about a rather expensive dinner in Canberra, which I won't go into, or the parliamentary cricket match. Every year just before Easter, the Parliament played press in a cricket match. And I'd just been promoted to be the Advertiser's political reporter to replace Ian Steele, who'd gone to work for the UN, and where he met and married a Miss Argentina, but that's another story. I go to the cricket match, which was at Adelaide Oval, arranged by Renda Garrison. I'm sitting there with my pads on, ready to go into bat, and one of the cadets from the Advertiser suddenly came up, and this was days before mobile phones, so no one, you couldn't keep in touch with the office, thank God, and said, look, the Chief of Staff wants you back at the office. There's a story we need you to follow up. And I said, well, wait a minute, it's Thursday, it's Good Friday tomorrow, there's no paper. It doesn't matter, he wants you back in the office. So I get back to the office, and there's the Chief of Staff, and it was John Sattley at the time, and he said, Rex Jury's got this story in the news. Now, we want you to follow it up. And I said, well, wait a minute. There's no paper tomorrow. I don't care. We want you to follow up this story. And, of course, so I sat down at the desk and started to make a few calls. And the thrust of the story I can barely remember was related to one particular Liberal MP. And so I rang on the telephone. We used to have to share phones in those days, one between 3 reporters. So I rang the MP concerned. His wife answered and said, no, he's not here. He's out about in the electorate. I don't know when he'll be coming back. So I sat in the office for 3 bloody hours, cooling my heels, waiting for this MP to ring back. I'd ring up every half an hour or so saying, is he back yet? Is he back yet? No, he's not back yet. And eventually, at about 5 o'clock, after the cricket match was over, I'd missed my chance to make 100 against John Bannon and whatever. And the phone rings and it's the MP and he says, oh, what do you want? And I said, oh, there's a story in the bloody news. Rex Jury's written it. Can I read it to you? And I read it to him. And he said, what, you've been sitting there all this time waiting for this? And I said, yeah, I missed the cricket match. And he said, I ought to sue that bastard. It's just another jury beat up. That's it.
Was he with the cricket match?
No. But, that's the sort of reaction you get from people, if you write stories. I think eventually in 6 months' time the stories proved to be correct. But, you've got a pretty good record, Rex. But as I said, once again, it's been a pleasure to work with and against Rex, and we'll miss him at the Advertiser, and perhaps I might be next cab off the rank. So, Rex introduced me to his accountant who said, look, I can fix you up. And so I went to his accountant, and his accountant came up with some figures that showed I have to work till I'm 89. I won't be here for a long while yet. But what I would do is ask you to all charge your glasses and I think drink a toast to one of the greatest journalists South Australia's ever produced, Rex Jury. Thank you very much.
Drink to Rex.
Can I have a drink too?
Go for it.
All right.
Now, Rex.
It's the same old boxes of you.
We keep getting it back. This one feels as though it's got a bit in it. Rex, I'm sure you'll find something to do with this. May you remember your luncheon today when you pop the bottle on, or pop the cork on this one. Thank you for speaking to us today. All the best in retirement, but no doubt we'll see you back here at our luncheons. Great to have you along today. I'm afraid of that. Okay. Now, we've got a raffle here just quickly. Joanna, you better come up and draw the raffle. Now, we'll mix them up a bit today. Now, we have a cordless phone, mobile phone from Telstra, was it? Cordless phone, Susan? Cordless phone from Telstra. Now, unfortunately, it's not here, but rest assured, Telstra will get it to you, or will get it to you somehow. So, first prize, a cordless phone from Telstra goes to...
Blue A78.
A78 is a blue one. There we go. Now, we had a $300 voucher here from Tim's Manufacturing Jewellers.
Black B34.
A black B34. Greg Kelton. Managed that well. And there's a carton of beer here. Not for you.
Green S67.
Nosky? Out the back? Okay, it's here for you afterwards. All right, just before you go... please remember to leave your business card outside so that we can send on any mailing list, put you on a mailing list or an email list for future functions. A couple of events coming up. Wednesday, the 27th of August, our speaker at Marketing Week will be Peter Williams, CEO of Deloitte Digital. And Peter is one of Australia's thought leaders on innovation and online, mobile and emerging technology. So there's a brochure there for you as you leave. And in your diary, please, also October 10, Peter Costello. His office came through, accepted our invitation today. His book is about to be published, about another month away. So who knows where Peter Costello, or what position he'll hold on October the 10th, but I'm sure he will be worth coming and listening to. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming today, and we look forward to seeing you again in the near future.